VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again at NobleKnight.com. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
My name is Harley Stroh, and I'm the line editor for the Dungeon Crawl Classics, and this is another classic edition of The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 125. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I will be joined by many others from around the internet in a third-party extravaganza! Only a bit of news to share in this episode, and that is that I've started doing some writing and reviewing on other websites. I'm starting to do a regular series on the At Will blog, where I give advice on giving your character a bit more character. And I'm also doing some product reviews over at Fistful of Comics and Games. My first review is on The Swords of Evening Stars, the first novel in a series in the Forgotten Realms by Ed Greenwood. And that will be linked in the show notes. But that's not the focus of today's show. In this episode, I'm joined by as many people as I could find in a third-party extravaganza! Each of us took one product from a third-party publisher that might be helpful in your D&D game. This could be PDFs, books, dice, screens, adventures, music. Who knows what you'll hear in this episode? Well, okay, I know what you'll hear in this episode, but you are going to have to find out as you listen. I have reviews from Jeremiah McCoy from the Basics of the Game podcast, Chris Hurd from the Icosahedrophilia podcast, Marcelo Dior from the Voices of the Third Earth Portuguese Language podcast, and Donnie from my own gaming group. Oh, and of course myself. About every other review will be from me. But before we get into that, I want to mention our sponsor for this episode, NobleKnight.com. They carry all of your new books and games, as well as specializing in finding out-of-print games for you. D&D, minis, board games, more. If you're looking to complete a collection or get rid of your own collection, NobleKnight.com is there to help you out. Check them out and tell them that The Tome Show and the Vorpal Network sent you. Normally, I have a pick of the episode to share, but instead of that, this time I thought I would just mention whenever one of our little 5-minute short reviews of a third-party extravaganza episode product is available at NobleKnight.com. And there will be links to all of them on the website.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.nobleknight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
I get to start things off with a look at an adventure from Goodman Games that I received as a review copy, to be upfront. In fact, you're probably going to hear several reviews of Goodman Game products in this episode because they're really good about sending review copies out to me, and I've spread them around to other people to help me review. But this review is going to be a miniature review of Dungeon Crawl Classic 56, Scions of Punjar, which is available at NobleKnight.com. Scions of Punjar is the second Goodman Games adventure set in the gritty city of Punjar. In this adventure, made for a party of 4th-level characters, there is a bit of a family problem spreading around that threatens more than a few people's reputation. The design of the adventure is unique in that it is generally non-linear. There is a chart of different ways that the party can move through the adventure setting and then eventually make it to one of the possible endings. In the end, the party uncovers the noble family's black sheep and deal with saving many lives in the process. The Goodman Games approach to the DCC line, the Dungeon Crawl Classics line, tends to be both its boon and its bane. It's designed to feel like a second edition game, but with fourth edition rules. To some degree, it works and captures some of the nostalgia that I used to enjoy back in my second edition days. But it also isn't afraid to stray into some new design space, like with the non-linear adventure design. The bane, however, is that too often they'll stick to the old-school gaming conventions and make the adventure perhaps a little bit less dynamic than it could have been if they had fully embraced 4th edition design concepts. But the story is solid, and if you're looking to make the rails of your story become less noticeable, giving the players a bit more freedom, and meanwhile sending them on a solid city-based adventure with a bit of insane horror factor, then the $14 for this module might just be right for you. Now, let's give someone else a chance to talk. Chris Hurd is going to tell you about the Chessex Dice Boot. It happens to be sold at NobleKnight.com, if your local game store doesn't have it. Chris?
Hello, Tome Show listeners. This is Chris Hurd of the Icosahedrophilia Podcast, and this is the sound of dice tumbling through a Chessex Dice Boot. I've thought about using a dice tower for some time now, and after long debates with myself about the various options, I finally decided to try the Chessex Dice Boot because of its portability. Unlike most other dice towers, the Chessex Dice Boot is specifically designed to be taken apart and stored compactly, then reassembled at your gaming venue. The boot, which gets its name from the shape of the right and left-hand side pieces, has a footprint of about 6 by 3 inches, and it stands about 7 inches tall. It's made out of clear acrylic, making it durable and adding some entertainment value as your colorful dice roll along the baffles. The boot has 4 baffles, where most of the other dice towers that I've seen only have 3. The boot's transparency makes it somewhat less attractive than other dice towers, but also removes any concerns about hanky-panky and allows everyone to see the dice without having to remove them from the tower itself. Once you've seen where all the pieces go, you can assemble or disassemble the dice boot in less than a minute. While disassembled, the boot slides easily into a quart-sized Ziploc baggie for storage and transportation. I've tested the boot with the standard 14mm Chessex dice, 10mm Koplo dice, and 20mm Koplo D10s, and all work just fine. The smallest gap between baffles is 30mm, so you'll need to keep your dice under that size if you use the boot. Admittedly, dice bouncing through an acrylic tower make a lot of noise. The boot's open bottom might be a drawback, depending on where you set the boot. If you set the boot on a hard surface like a hard plastic or wooden table, you're likely to get some dice bouncing out of the boot. You can mitigate this somewhat by placing the boot on a more pliable surface. A layer of felt works fine and looks right at home on the gaming table, but might give you some cocked dice unless it's smoothed down very well. I've also tried grip mats, but those tend to grab your dice early and cause them to bunch up at the heel of the boot rather than running out to its toe, which also results in some cocked dice, especially when you're rolling 6 or 7 at a time. So far, the best surface I've found is a simple legal pad. In a dozen rolls of a full 7-die Chessex standard set, rolling on paper has given me no bounce-outs and only one roll where any of the dice were cocked. Pyramid-shaped 4-sided dice can sometimes end up slightly cocked on the lowest baffle, though, especially if other dice in the same roll stop short. Still, it's not too hard to tell which side is up on a cocked D4. If you're in the market for a dice tower and you want an attractive, fantasy-themed one that looks good on the table, you won't want the Chessex Dice Boot. But if you want a dice tower that's easy to carry around in a backpack, this one will definitely do the job for you.
Okay, thanks, Chris. It is my turn again, and since we just heard about the Dice Boot, why don't I tell you about some dice that I got for review from Q Workshop, which you can buy at NobleKnight.com. Man, they've got everything. Q Workshop is a fantastic dice company. They're relatively small, based in Europe, but they make very unique dice. Not the typical pips or numbers, but dice with some style. Runic, Elven, or in this case, the ones I've been playing with are steampunk. Q Workshop sent me a set of steampunk dice to review, and I have to say, I honestly wasn't sure I liked them. I've looked at their dice a lot, and one of my main requirements for dice is being able to read the number off of a roll in a moment. Q Workshop dice tend to have a lot of art and decoration, and I've always been a little bit worried looking at them and being interested in them that I wouldn't be able to read the number quickly because it was so stylized or surrounded by all this extra stuff. However, I am pleased to report that at least when using the steampunk dice, I'm able to read the numbers quickly and easily, and so far, I've even been rolling quite well with them. Steampunk may not be the perfect style for a D&D game, but the color combination is just about perfect for me, and the decoration works just about as well for a 4th edition D&D game as it does for anything else. So, Cute Workshop is something I've looked at for a long time, something I've been very interested in, but it's also something I've been a little hesitant to jump into. This review set of dice puts me over the edge. Q Workshop gets a big thumbs up from me, and I'm thinking of replacing all of my dice with more from their sets. Now, I'm going to take another break. Let's hear from Jeremiah McCoy, who had a chance to talk about Tieflings, a book by Goodman Games that I got as a review copy and sent off to him, and is also available at our sponsor's website, NobleKnight.com.
Hello! My name is Jeremiah McCoy. I'm here for the Tome Show. Jeff asked me to do a quick little review of the Heroes Handbook, Tiefling, by Goodman Games. Jeff and I actually play in the same D&D book, D&D group together, and he suggested that he needed some reviews of, just little quick reviews of some of the third-party products that are out there, and, you know, see if they were interesting, if they were something people would need or want. So I thought I'd take a look at this. Now, this is part of the line of products of player resources that Goodman Games has turned out. They've done a number of hero handbooks, the Tiefling, the Eladrin, and the Dragonborn so far. Maybe they'll turn out more. It sounds like they plan to. They've also turned out some for different classes as well. Now, one of the interesting things on this one is it's listed as being developed as by Harley Stroh, but the two writers here are Jeff LaSala and Aaron Blackridge Rudell. It's 1999, soft cover, roughly 93 pages of content. Now, all of these books and some of the information that comes out of the Level Up magazine and a couple of the other things that they've turned out as support products rather than adventures have the assumed world of a place called Aerith. That's A-E-R-E-T-H. However you're supposed to pronounce that. I'm not actually sure. Anyways, it's kind of like Greyhawk was the assumed setting of 3rd edition D&D. Aerith is the assumed setting for all of their sort of support material that they're writing this way. Now, in this assumed setting, Tiefling or Tiefling, depending on how you're pronouncing it, and I'm never really clear on that one either, Tiefling are all descended from a set of progenitors, a set of devils that seem to be the benefactors of the line. In fact, they're called the Lord Benefactor, or Lady Benefactor, I guess. And those benefactors also give a subset to Tieflings called a legacy. Now, the book says there are 15 legacies, but they only give you the details on 8 of them. Each legacy gives you access to some feats and a paragon path. These are, of course, tied to the devil on which they're drawn from. An example would be the Legacy of Lust, which has the benefactor of Lilith, the archdemon. Her paragon path is the Pharomancer, built around using influence on others, and, of course, her first feat is Animal Attraction. They follow a theme like that. Now, the Pharomancer, of course, is built around a lot of charisma damage. They do a lot of effects that are controlling other characters. And that's their theme because it's lust and Lilith. Those are sort of the images that you have. And all of the legacies work sort of like that. Now, they have a section with feats. They're built on sort of like the divine boons that you find in the feats in the player's handbook, except they're infernal in theme. That's really their only draw in that regard. I mean, they're pretty standard feats. They give you bonuses to some things, you know, things like that. Now, the interesting part on the feats section, though, is that they introduce something called malisons, which are curses, which give you powers. This is supposed to be some sort of curse that was laid upon you by a benefactor of another legacy. It gives you a power, but the power has a distinct downside as well. The example I can give you is the alluring gaze power, which, if you gain it from Malisons, you know, gives you a certain amount of power over whoever you use it on. But when the effect runs its course, the victim gets combat advantage on you. Now, the Malisons can be taken as an extra feat over and above your normal feats. You're only allowed one, but you can take them as an extra feat over and above. I'm not sure if this is unbalancing or not, but it's there. Now, the tail end of the book is a section of magic items with an infernal theme. Nothing outstanding here. It's fairly standard stuff that you would have seen, but it's all within an infernal sort of devil theme to it. Now, the final word, as far as I'm concerned, on this book is it's okay. It did not blow me away with either the art or the writing, but it's not particularly bad either. The theme of the essentially infernal bloodline is appealing to some folks. It may not fit with every campaign. It would be easier to fit this into some campaigns than others. The use of all the lore that they invent for the bloodlines, the legacies, to make sense would mean bringing some of that lore into your campaign to make it fit. Now, if you want to do that extra work to either A, change how they are flavored, you know, come up with a whole new names and things to relate it to make it fit into your campaign, you could do that. Or you could change your campaign to make them fit. But either way, that's going to be more work in some campaigns than others. I suspect if you're running an Aerith campaign, it fits fine. That said, if you're looking for more options in playing a tiefling, this is one source that is not half bad. There is a lot here to fit whatever style of character you're playing. Unless, of course, you're me, because I'm the oddball who decided a lawful good cleric tiefling is the way to go. But most folks are going to find a lot of options here for further defining your tiefling, making it a little more flavorful. And for that, I think this is a really good book. Anyways, my name is Jeremiah McCoy, and you're listening to The Tome Show. And back to Jeff.
And thank you for that, Mr. McCoy. Next up, I'm going to talk about the review download I got of the Ultimate GM screen from Fat Dragon Games. So I've kind of toyed around with the idea of doing the elaborate 3D terrain models using a lot of the things like Fat Dragon Games products. The idea of their products is you get PDFs, you print them off on cardstock, you fold them and glue them in certain ways, and you get this really cool looking 3D model of the walls of the dungeon and the doors and the statue and the trees and all the cool things in your terrain, and so your miniatures can run around in it as if they were actually there, and it really has this potential to set the mood of your game because it looks like your heroes are there in the location. D&D, but I would actually be supporting two hobbies, playing D&D and making three-dimensional terrain out of cardstock paper and all that. But I had some time last summer, so I snagged a review download of the Ultimate GM Screen 2. There were some minor problems, mostly probably due to my lack of experience, but for the most part, things went rather well, and I can totally live with the final product. There were a few bits here and there where the instructions weren't quite clear, or something was marked actually incorrectly, but if you looked at the directions, it cleared it up a little bit. When it's all said and done, I ended up with a really cool DM screen. It's got a few curved walls here and there, or a gap between this part and that part, but for a first-timer, I can accept that I did that. The upside for me as a D&D DM is that it has these really cool shelves in the back. It's actually a three-dimensional screen, and it has these little shelves in the back so I can put my miniatures back there. And it's sturdy, and it adds some ambiance having this screen that is a big 3D model of a castle instead of having just a normal, almost, your typical cardboard or cardstock screen. The downsize. It is maybe a bit too tall for my taste personally. I'd rather it maybe be about an inch to a half an inch shorter just to make it easier so I could reach over and not knock it around or whatever as I'm using it. Not a huge deal, something I can get around. You also do have to keep in mind that you're going to be printing a good amount of color pages on cardstock. That can drive up the price, because now not only are you paying for the download, but then you're paying for your ink and your cardstock. So keep that in mind when you make a decision if this is for you. And then, of course, the natural downside is that it doesn't have all the nifty charts and things that you like to have for your DM screen, especially if you're compared to the Wizards of the Coast DM screen, which is also very, very good. I'm kind of working on that to mitigate that issue. Soon, I hope to have a couple of sheets where I've created sort of my own version of some of the what I consider to be the most important charts that I can kind of glue on to the empty bits on the inside of the screen, and I should be good to go. And I think it'll solve a lot of my problems, and I look forward to using it for a long time. Okay, time for me to be quiet again and let Chris Hurd talk to you about music. Music to Game by Sonic Legends.
Hello, Tome Show listeners. This is Chris Hurd of the Icosahedrophilia Podcast, welcoming you inside the Prosperous Tavern soundscape by Erica Lieberman, published by Erica's company Sonic Legends. Sonic Legends burst on the RPG music scene right around Halloween 2009, and they now offer over 20 different soundscapes for use at your gaming table. What's that? Oh, excuse me just a moment. A wizened old man has entered the tavern looking for adventurers. Hold on a second while my party negotiates with him. As you can hear, my party's in a bit of a pickle right now. We accepted the old man's commission, but as we passed through the forest to the ruined castle, we found ourselves ambushed. Fortunately, there's a Sonic Legends soundscape for that. Forest Skirmish, with music by Christy Carew and sound effects by Erica Lieberman. Most of Sonic Legends' offerings run in the fantasy genre, although a handful of their soundscapes currently available develop modern, futuristic, or even apocalyptic themes. What? Oh, excuse me just a moment. Our defender has gone down, and I'm the cleric. I'll be right back.
Thank you.
The old man at the tavern told us that his MacGuffin was somewhere in this old ruined castle, but he failed to warn us just how creepy it would be in here. At any rate, our DM picked up some great music for ambiance. Vampire Castle by Erica Lieberman. Is there really a vampire in this castle? I don't know, but I do know that Erica's soundscape sets the mood perfectly. These three tracks and several others are now available at DriveThruRPG.com or at SonicLegends.com. I haven't even mentioned Dungeon Prison by Jack Walker, The Other World by John Olson, Degenerate Seaside Town by Matthew Steckler, one of my favorites, or any of the other soundscapes available. At last count, I think Sonic Legends offered 23 different soundscapes. The tracks are excellent. Not quite perfect. I did have to fiddle with the ID3 tags a little in order to organize the tracks well within my iTunes library. But that's pretty minor. Now, some DMs might be a little bit scared away by the price of $2.99 per track, especially if you're used to paying 99 cents per track at the iTunes store or other places. However, realize that you're getting 8 to 10 minutes of Sonic Legends music for your $2.99, which is pretty much comparable to three 3-minute iTunes tracks for 99 cents each. Also, these tracks are designed specifically for RPG play, for use at your game table, and so they loop very, very well. In effect, each track is basically infinite, because you can play it over and over and over and over and over again as long as your scene requires. As a DM, I am personally very excited about using Sonic Legends soundscapes in my games.
And I hope you enjoyed that review from Chris Hurd. Now it's my turn to talk again, and I'm going to talk about a review download of an iPod Touch or iPhone application called the DM Tracker. If you have an iPod Touch or an iPhone and are looking for a way to track your D&D game without having to bring a whole laptop to your game, then maybe the DM tool is the right pick for you. It tracks statistics of your PCs, NPCs, monsters, whatever. It will help keep track of hit points, conditions, initiative, from the start of a fight right to the end. The upside? It does exactly what it's supposed to do. It looks good. I found no bugs or quirks with it. It's a really solid program. The downside? You would have to have a way to keep your battery charged in the device for the entire game. Plus, you have to enter all of the statistics for the creatures and the PCs manually, using the little virtual keyboard in your iPod Touch or iPhone, which is exceedingly time-consuming. If there was some way to set up encounters on my computer and then have it brought in to the device, or if all of the creatures from the Wizards of the Coast SRD were already automatically entered into the application, the usefulness of this device or of this application would expand exponentially. I mean, it would be huge. The only thing stopping me from using this a lot is just the time consumption of having to enter all that information manually. All in all, it's a really solid program. It's $3, and it makes, although it does maybe make prep time a little bit longer, but a good product. Okay, it's time to hear from Donnie. Donnie's going to tell us about a book called In Search of Adventure, also a review copy, also from Goodman Games. Donnie, take it away.
Hello, listeners. Donnie here with a review of In Search of Adventure from Goodman Games. But first, a brief introduction. Some of you are wondering, who is this Donnie? Well, I'm a member of Jeff's current 4th edition campaign, and he was foolish enough to let me have 5 minutes of airtime here on the Tome Show. And now, on with the review. In Search of Adventure is an offering of 6 first-level adventures for D&D 4th edition, and is published by Goodman Games. The book itself comes in paperback with heavy stock, non-glossy pages, a nice feature for DMs who love to scribble notes in the margins. While the maps and pictures are all in black and white, they are still detailed enough to provide a good view of the action. However, I do wish there was a consistency in how the maps were oriented. Some maps are easily read, while others require you to turn the book on its side, a bit of a hassle, especially at the gaming table. But what about the adventures themselves? All 6 adventures are geared towards the standard party of 5 PCs, with clear instructions on scaling depending on party strength. although some of the adventures can be a bit of a challenge even for larger parties. More on that in a bit. Thematically, there's a wide range from module to module. Ruined wizard towers, misplaced pyramids, and deep labyrinths serve as just a few of the settings offered in the collection. Each adventure also serves as a starting point for a campaign, with ideas from the author on what direction the campaign can take once the adventure is concluded. The desert-based adventure has gotten me particularly excited to dig out some old source material and run an updated Al-Qadim game for 4th edition. The types of encounters and monsters that PCs will face are also well varied. The editor did an excellent job to make sure that nothing overlaps from one adventure to the next. Encounters are a good mix between large-scale battles, solo fights, skill challenges, and tricky puzzles. DMs should be careful, though. While these adventures are all designed for first level, they probably cannot be used as one-shots without some modifications. Adventures can be anywhere from 7 to 18 encounters long. If your group tends to take their time, be prepared to cover several sessions with one adventure. Overall, the adventures have an old-school feel to them. They rely less on the three-encounter formula that Wizards of the Coast has made part of the Dungeon Delve series, and opts instead for a much more classical style in its dungeon construction. Not all adventures take place indoors, but those that do feel a bit cramped. Hallways tend to be long and narrow, 5 to 10 feet wide, with several branching rooms for heroes to explore at will. With 4E's emphasis on tactical movement, shifting, pushing, sliding, etc., this lack of real estate may hamper PCs and DMs alike. I had the opportunity to run one of the adventures here as part of an evening's one-shot, with a few cuts to the number of encounters. This is where the most interesting aspect of In Search of Adventure becomes very apparent. These adventures are tough. I mean, really, really tough. I took a party of 6 PCs into the Pyramid of the Scorpion Queen, and only 3 made it out alive. And that's even after they mitigated the final encounter by triggering the deadly sandstorm at the very beginning of the session. I don't care how much min-maxing you do. Ongoing damage, plus a chance to be knocked prone and flung from the roof of a pyramid, all while fighting a level 4 solo creature, is extremely harsh at level 1. Granted, this adventure I ran was the most challenging the book has to offer, but a read through the other modules shows that this is not a book meant for new players or DMs. While some of the encounters may not be meant to wipe out a complete party, they can still be challenging for a novice DM to run smoothly. Overall, like the publisher's namesake, this book of adventures is good. Not great, but good. At $19.99, this may be a bit spendy for some DMs considering what it offers, and is by no means a must-have. This is especially true if all you're looking for are some good campaign ideas, or want to cherry-pick some of the encounters. However, if you need a strong start to your latest campaign, or just want to see your players cry uncle, then In Search of Adventure will be a fine addition to your DM library.
Thank you, Donnie. That was good. Now, I'm up to talk again. This time, another review download that I got from Precise Intermedia called Disposable Heroes Fantasy Set 6, or, as I like to call it, Big Critters. I reviewed Disposable Heroes from Precise Intermedia a while back in the PCDM Resources episode, and had mostly good things to say about their product. One of the few critical comments I had to share was that there was no good way to have creatures that were larger than medium size. Well, with this set, they've provided me with my wish. Large monsters. Wyverns, dragons, demons, ogres, trolls, and more. Black and white, color, trifold, or for use with the little plastic stands, the set is awesome. The static set that you can't customize is $5, while the customizable set is $8. Plus, of course, the cost of printing. I find the customizable versions to be pretty awesome, but it may not be worth the extra cost considering how good the static version actually is. My only concern now is that I like to use the little plastic stand version of the minis, and if I do that, my monsters still won't take up the needed 4 squares. It's a pretty easy fix with a little square of paper to sit underneath the base, or even you could print off one of the token versions of the miniature and use that underneath. It's a small pet peeve of mine. Not a big deal, but something I thought I would share. Well, since we're talking about paper miniatures, why don't we go ahead and throw it over to Chris Hertigan, who's going to talk to us once more about a map that we can put those miniatures on. He's going to talk about the Game Mastery Flip Pad Mat from Paizo Publishing. Chris, take it away.
Hey, Tome Show listeners.
This is Chris Hurd of the Icosahedrophilia podcast again with another product review for you. Many of you are probably aware of Paizo Publishing's line of Game Mastery flip mats, originally the brainchild of Steel Squire founder Jeff Peterson. These maps measure 24 by 30 inches when unfolded, and they fold up nicely to 8 by 10 inches. If you remember the quality of the cartography and illustrations back in the day when Paizo was publishing Dungeon and Dragon magazine, or you've seen the quality of the cartography for the Pathfinder game, well, that's the level of quality you can expect from the flip mats. In other words, the artwork is gorgeous. Paizo has taken two different approaches to the maps. Most of the maps have fully developed encounter areas on both sides. For example, the brand new Pathfinder Lodge map, appropriately named, features the ground floor on one side and a second story on the other side. Some DMs will actually find that they want two copies of certain maps so that they can have action going on both sides at the same time. Imagine a goblin assault on the Pathfinder Lodge, for example. You might want goblins coming in through the second story windows as others rush the first floor. Other maps are essentially blank on one side, except for the ground or flooring. For example, the City Market map has an open-air market on one side, and the flip side is just pavement, so that you can draw in your own features as you wish. You can draw on the maps with wet erase markers, dry erase markers, or even permanent markers, and then erase the maps for later reuse. Now, the bar brawl that begins in episode 49 of my own podcast, Icosahedrophilia, which may not be out quite yet at the time you hear this episode of the Tome Show, was conducted on Paizo's Waterfront Tavern flip mat. When you listen to City of the Pirate Kings Part 1, you'll hear the players commenting on several features of the map. One side of the Waterfront Tavern map gives you just what you think when you hear the name, a large tavern situated right on the pier. You can literally tie off a small boat and walk right into the tavern without actually setting foot on land. There are tables to sit at, food preparation areas, a bar, and rooms for rent. On the flip side, the map features grayish water suitable for the harbor itself. For the same gaming session, I also brought along the theater flip mat, though the player's choices meant that the PCs never actually went to the theater. The theater flip mat depicts just what the name suggests, a large theater complete with stage and luxury boxes. The flip side consists entirely of wooden flooring on which you can draw in the walls or other features you want to create backstage areas at the theater or a warehouse layout, for example. This actually fills an important gap in my own toolbox because the Wizards of the Coast has released so few dungeon tiles featuring wooden flooring. Paizo's recommended price for each flip mat is $12.99, and there are quite a few flip mats now in the series. Other vendors, such as FRP Games, sell them for as much as 20% off of that price. You can also get a 20% discount directly from Paizo by subscribing to the series, which also ensures that you won't miss any new flip mats. Personally, I'm very happy with all of the flip mats that I own. I think they're definitely worth the price. The maps are durable and store away very easily alongside my D&D miniatures battle maps. The only real downside to the Paizo flip mats is their versatility. If you're only going to have one opportunity per campaign for your players to visit the theater, you might be reluctant to purchase a flip mat just for that purpose. This is where the handy reverse sides can, in my opinion, make or break a flip mat sale. For example, I love the Waterfront Tavern map and the theater map because I can also use the reverse blank sides for many different applications. I can always use a big field of water. I can always use a big wooden floor. I doubt that I'll buy the Darklands map, though, for example, because I don't want to send my players over and over into caverns that look just like the last caverns they encountered. That's why I prefer to buy my flip mats a la carte instead of via subscription. But any flip mat whose illustration meets your needs and that you'll use multiple times is a very good investment for a GM who wants visually attractive encounter settings out on the table.
Thank you very much for that last review, Chris. Turns out I have another Dungeon Crawl Classic adventure from Goodman Games. This time, DCC 58, Forgotten Portal. Forgotten Portal is easily one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Dungeon Crawl Classics modules that I've read, and I've seen most all of the 4th edition Dungeon Crawl Classics line. The design is dynamic, the story is engaging, the trappings grab me in a lot of ways. The party of 4th level PCs accidentally stumbles upon a set of treasure that leads to a local tribe of natives and then causes them to believe that they are prophesied warriors. They uncover a hidden plot of an ancient gods and that oppose each other, and in the end, they save the day while not ending the story. My favorite thing about this adventure is that the opening hook is so flexible and well-written, it could fit into any campaign. And the ending doesn't end the story. You don't have to finish your campaign, but rather it gives you a ton of ideas and hooks for the next leg of the story, helping you keep your campaign alive while still not forcing you to turn those hooks into your entire campaign if you don't want to. The adventure does exactly what I want from purchased adventures. It integrates really well into nearly any campaign I want to run it in. It gives me a breather as a DM while I'm running it. It does some of the work for me, but it doesn't interrupt my current story. The only thing I don't like about this is the pseudo-Native American feel that it sort of assumes in their setting. This can be changed to some degree, but you do have to give up some of the flavor of the story when you do that. So, if you can make a 4th-level adventure with a tribe of jungle natives fit into your campaign, I don't think you'll be disappointed with this adventure at $16. Even if you get it for the story and restat all the adventures for your campaign, I wouldn't think this is a bad idea. I would recommend you check it out. And of course, it is worth noting that it is available at NobleKnight.com. And finally, Marcelo Dior is going to wrap things up with a look at a web application called iPlay4E. Marcelo, take it away.
Okay, here's Marcelo, and that's my 5 minutes review, about 5 minutes review of the iPlay4E web application. The address to that app is iPlay4E.appspot.com. It's iPlay4E.appspot.com. You're going to see a green screen with a login link at the top. The first thing you need to do in order to use the application is to log in, and you can use your Google account for that. First positive point, you don't have to create yet another web account. Well, now that you've logged in, there's a lot of things you can do. The first one, the more obvious one, is to upload your DDI character or characters to iPlay4E. Just click on the upload link at the top right corner, find where Character Builder holds your characters, and click upload. It's usually on My Documents, DDI, Saved Characters. You can upload only one character at a time. Before hitting upload, you also have the option to make it public. If you don't want your character to be found by people looking for characters shared in iPlay4E, just uncheck the box right below the upload button. But one of the interesting aspects of this app is that users create a pool of characters. So if you need an Eladrin or any 11th level character, or something more specific, if you need an Eladrin rogue of 11th level, you can just browse and see if someone had built that character and put it there. Okay, once you have your character uploaded to iPlay4E, it's going to be visible at the screen, and that's the template format to all characters that you'll find on this app. You have a lot of options, and it takes some getting used to with the interface. But the important buttons are the ones at the top, just below your character's name. If you hover the cursor over any given button, it will tell you what you're going to find it. For example, the two crossing swords give access to information like initiative, speed, defenses, hit points, and the like. And you will also notice that you can actually input data on several places of the sheet. In the combat tab, for example, you can set conditions, temporary hit points, damage, determine if your character has used his or her second wind, heal, etc. All sorts of things that you should alter on a paper character sheet. And iPlay4E is integrated with DDI itself. Let's take a look at the powers tab, for example. I've uploaded a first level wizard. If I go to the powers tab and click on Acid Arrow, that I know it's a daily power because it's written in black. I could have chosen Chill Strike, which is written in red, so I know it's an encounter power. But let's go to Acid Arrow. The first thing I see that I can do is mark it as used or unused. But I can also click on the tiny blue disc with a question mark inside. It's beside the text acid arrow and also besides my implements. That button is a link, and it will take me directly to a description of the power in the D&D compendium. In the case of the acid arrow, I'm going to see the power description. The other nice and useful things I can do inside a power is to roll for it. There is a red, kind of pink actually, D20 besides my implements. So if I click there, guess what? It pops up a rolling for you. That's very useful if you play using your laptop, but I think the two greatest uses for iPlay4E are online play and in between sessions DM management. Here's how you do that. Right before your character's name, there is the icon of a star, a golden star. If you click on it, you will see an interface where you can manage your character. You can download it in the Character Builder format or even in XML. You can link it with your Epic Worlds campaign. Epic Worlds is just like Obsidian Portal. You can put it on your iGoogle screen, see it as HTML, to put it on your blog or website, and you can share it with specific users of iPlay4E. The way I use it is to have all my players share their characters with me. That way, I can see those characters on the left side column. There are three options on that column. You have search characters, where you can search for that 11th level Eladrin rogue. You can see my characters, well, actually, your characters. And you can see shared characters. The PCs that your players shared with you are going to be there. If you click on the red pin, they'll be presented on your screen. Now it's a good time to buy that widescreen monitor because they're put side by side. If you have a lot of characters, you're going to have a lot of horizontal scrolling to do. As the DM, you can't manage everything your players can inside the characters, but you can see all the information they've updated. I myself have to look at it every week to see if my players have updated their gold, XP, and the like. But that's a good thing, because my players are learning to keep their sheets tidy. They can update their sheets on Character Builder and then re-upload their characters to iPlay4E or update them on iPlay4E and then download them to the Character Builder directory on their own computers. There's one downside to iPlay4E. Once a player shared a character with you, there's no way you can delete it. The only way to do that is if the owner of the character deletes his character. You, as the DM, cannot do that. So it's kind of a nuisance if you are on your third, fourth campaign and you're going to have 20, 25 characters on your shared characters area. Well, that's all the time I'm allowed to spend on this little app. And there's a lot of other cool options to explore on iPlay4E. Take a look. I think you're going to like it. Thanks, Jeff, for the time. Thank you for listening. Back to you, Jeff.
And thank you for that review, Marcelo. Well, we've looked at a lot of different third-party products from a ton of different publishers. Hopefully, there's something in there for everyone. I want to thank all of our guests for this episode and our sponsor, NobleKnight.com. Don't forget to tell them that the Tome Show sent you. And that, my friends, is episode 125. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. Make sure you get out there and tell people about the show. Word of mouth is the best way for the podcast to grow, and you guys are the only ones who can make that happen. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. And this has been episode 125. Third Party Extravaganza! Of?
I'm on the wall.